Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never that debt is fraud as we continue our appeals to heaven. Then we are benefiting from learning and understanding the source documents, what our government did, how they did it, and whether they should be doing it or not, believe it or not. And so, welcome back, Sean. We're still in the throes of going through the Constitution, that's a good thing. And as we kind of wrapped up yesterday, I was going through the Washington State Constitution, and I didn't get a chance to have you kind of pipe in and go, yeah, that's exactly what I'm seeing here, and I'm not sure if it's that visible for you, but hopefully that is. And so here's the interesting thing. In the state of Washington, they actually laid out apportionment for the representatives for each of the people of the counties. And so this is how it started off. Divided among the several counties of the state following in the manner. The county of Adams shall have one representative. The county of Ashton shall have one. In other words, when you go through every county, let me find Stevens, because we knew Stevens County was split between Spokane. And so where is Stevens? The county of Stevens shall have one representative. So in the Constitution, there has been no amendments to this at all. And I say that because when you go into another, let's go up to a place where I know that we've probably got some amendments. Let's say education. And we got the education. So you see how they actually include the amendment that changed it in 1966. You see that? And so this is the original text of what it was before, and then they show you what the next amendment was. So they list, the way Washington State does their constitution, at the end of each article, they will list all the different amendments that have been made to that article. We actually have articles that have been completely done away with because they either moved it, joined it, or what have you, to another article, and so we just kind of have really nothing, and I've seen that in other states as well. But the fact is, folks, that in the state of Washington, the state of Washington's constitution is very similar to the U.S. Constitution, where each county, the people of each county have a minimum of one representative. And they basically tried to apportion it so that the Senate would kind of have equal representation amongst the population of the counties. But still, each county was accounted for in that one representative, and it wasn't broken down by actual population. It was broken down by the population of the counties. And actual population is this concept of one person, one vote, and it is a concept of democracy. We created our own Republican form of government. We created, and every state that joined the Union after the original 13, and all 13 states have gone to the drawing table and have rewritten their constitutions and or amended it and so forth. And therefore, today, or what they ended up by the mid-1900s, is every state had a very similar framework to the federal constitution. In other words, bicameral legislative bodies. The choosing of the president was very similar, not by electoral college. By that point in time, everything was democracy or democratic, I should say. And so we can see how they started deviating and going down the path of going more and more democratic instead of republican. The electoral college is what actually makes the selection of the president very Republican. In other words, if you look at the 12th Amendment, when it comes down to if the Electoral College can't choose the president, it goes to the House of Representatives, and each house gets what? One vote. California, with all of these representatives, they only get one vote. This is why they have basically, this is kind of in this unwritten rule, but I believe it's written down. They won't tell you this is written down. They will never allow the 12th Amendment ever to be invoked in an election. This is why they've been playing these shenanigans with voter fraud and election fraud. And it doesn't matter how crazy it gets and how stupid it gets. They will never invoke the 12th Amendment. Because when people see what the 12th Amendment does, then all of a sudden it becomes the game changer. Anyway, so because when we actually look at, so here's an interesting thing. Sean, you know how many states have made up some really weird rules regarding their electoral college. One of those weird rules is the winner-take-all rule. And so I'm just trying to frame a perspective regarding representation and this concept of, you know, how we're being represented in the selecting of the president, how we're represented in, you know, the Congress in both the House and so forth. And so are you familiar with the winner-take-all rule, that if the Democrats, you know, have a majority in a popular vote, they give all the Electoral College towards the president? In other words, the Democrat. So, I mean, are you familiar? Let me ask you this. Are you familiar with how the electors are chosen in your state? All states basically do it the same way.
No, sir.
Okay. The parties, unbeknownst to anybody, most people don't know this, the parties actually meet in advance and they choose their electors so that when they have the popular vote, if the Democratic president wins, then the Democratic Party sends all the electors that they chose because they're a winner-take-all state. In other words, let's think about it this way. If they applied the same representation, if they applied the same representation for the House of Representatives to say that the Democrats voted more for representation in the House of Representatives and they said winner takes all the representatives, that would literally take away the voice of people in congressional districts that do not have a Democratic leaning. In other words, if you really think about it, it's unconscionable to actually take away the suffrage of the people. Because in a Republican form of government, it's not about democracy. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So the winner-take-all, if you really think about it, that winner-take-all concept is kind of repugnant, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It is. But here's the interesting thing. When you look at the 12th Amendment, when the House of Representatives goes in to choose the president, in other words, they go into chambers and they come back because they vote by delegation. In other words, California will get one vote. They don't get, you know, the Democrat and Republican votes. So when we look at the Electoral College, they align the Electoral College to be very similar. I should say the popular vote and the winner-take-all concept. They did that to be very similar with the 12th Amendment. That being said, they know, and you know as well as I do, that because of the shenanigans that they play with in a lot of these battleground states, even though the state representation still, you know, goes down that path of you're still getting the same amount of representatives. In other words, we see the ebb and flow of the House of Representatives going back and forth between Republican and Democrat. But when we see the presidential election of that year, you'll actually see, like in 2020, when Biden won, supposedly Biden won, the House of Representatives may have slid a little bit towards the Democrats. But the reality is that it didn't slide in the same manner as the presidential votes. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, so I went into, and I'm down in a rat hole on this, but I went into the 2012 election, and I counted how many votes were cast for the House of Representatives, all votes. In other words, independents and everything. I went in and I looked at, you know, what were the total votes in every state for the House of Representatives? Not,
you know, who the Democratic vote against the Republican vote and totaling those, all the votes. And so, because you can actually get those numbers. And when I added up for each state, how many votes for representatives, and then I added up how many votes for president, not just the president, you know, the Democrat and Republican president, all the votes. So you can actually pull these numbers, and it was astronomically different that there were a lot more votes for president than there were for the House of Representatives. And this is odd because every seat in the House of Representatives is open for the election. In other words, everybody's voting, you know, in both of those races. In other words, every person is getting a ballot to choose both the president and their representative in Congress, their House of Representatives in Congress. So how is it that we had such a big disparity? There are that many votes for president. That is, why are these overage votes? These are literally over votes because, let me ask you this. Do you believe that a person only votes for president? There could be a very small percentage of people that that's all they fill out. They only vote for president. But I don't believe most people being ideological, they take the time to fill out the entire ballot. Right? I mean, I would think that it would probably be less than 1% of Americans would only vote for president. And yet when you add up the numbers in 2012, what we were looking at was it was something like 11 million. Let me get this right. For the president, there were these overages. Okay, yes, there were overages. So in 2012, the overage was, I think we were looking almost 6 million. It was 5 million something. In other words, there were 5 million more votes for Obama, and I think the overall presidential race. But here's the interesting thing. In 2012, not everybody voted for president. Remember I said, you know, everybody will vote for president? That was an election where it was denoted that millions of people did not cast a vote for president because there were these evangelicals and Christians that refused to vote for a Mormon and they refused to vote for Obama. So they did not cast a ballot. Are you familiar with that? No? Yes?
Yes.
Okay. So in looking at that right there, they did a poll. And they came up with, there were several polls, but they came up with, out of all these polls, somewhere between 11 million votes that did not get cast for the president at all, from 11 to something like 20-some-odd million. So what I did was I split the difference, and I said 17 million votes were not cast. So what that means is that when you're really looking at the House of Representatives, that total, and the difference being 5 million more for president, now I have to take 17 million and add that to the president because there were that many more ballots cast. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because we're adding 17 more million to the House of Representatives. Because the House of Representatives being 5 million less, and we know that the president didn't get votes for 17 million people, you have to throw those numbers out there to account for that difference. So technically, when you really look at the total presidential votes that were out there, it was 22 million in difference between the House of Representatives. Or it should have been. The disparity, if everything was one for one, there should be 17 million less for president than the House of Representatives. But it wasn't that way. Even though the polls showed that 17 million people didn't vote for president. So hopefully this is now maybe making sense of how I'm presenting this. That number for the president should have been down below 17 million for the House of Representatives. Because everybody gets their same ballot and that, you know, I believe that everybody does vote for their representative in Congress. That those are the two votes or those are the two blocks that are always filled out more often than not. I think it's a real outlier to find person only voting for president. So the question is this, is how is it that there were 5 million more? Which means if you add the 5 million minus the 17, that's 22 million more votes only for president. In other words, those were ballots that got stuffed in that the Democrats got away with and basically changing. And if you look at where the majority of the outliers were, they were in battleground states. In other words, if you looked at it, I think it was like 80% of all of the real variances in the ballots were in the battleground states. So in other words, they knew that they needed to get the Electoral College or the votes for the president up in these very particular states to get the electors to move to ensure that Obama got elected. So the point is that when we really look at this winner-take-all rule, and we're, you know, just kind of forging ahead in, you know, these elections and who gets to be, you know, based on the count, voter fraud and election fraud is steep. But interestingly enough, with the winner-take-all, they did model that towards the 12th Amendment outcome. But they know that the fix is in, and that's why it's important that they wanted to have winner-take-all, because all they needed to do was tip the scales over for the electors in the popular vote instead of actually having to play with the congressional vote, because then it would have required a lot more to get each of the congressional districts so that you had the proper number for the Electoral College, so that each, because if every elector was representative of the, you know, the red legislature, the congressional districts, now you actually have to have a lot more, you know, votes to carry it across the finish line to take that state if they're actually dividing the votes that way. So in other words, it makes it easier for them to cheat by using winner take all. It wasn't about really trying to mirror it towards the 12th Amendment. And they know this because what would end up happening is when you really look at the states in 2020, the delegation of Congress was 30 to 20. In other words, there were 30 states that had a majority, like Wyoming, there was one representative, only one representative for Republican. And the same thing with the, Montana, the Dakotas, they all got one representative because their population was that small. And so I think the two Dakotas, Wyoming, there's a couple of other states out there that I think, you know, there's only one vote for them. I think Maine's another one. So the point is that when you look at the states where they have multiples, where, you know, there's lots of them, taking away the red counties or the red congressional districts really requires a lot more votes if you did it by the proper electoral college process. The proper electoral college process is we the people choose our electors, not the party, which means that you would have a disparity instead of winner take all. It would be how the people voted, and we would probably find that the election for the representatives would mirror the same as the elector, because it'll be Republicans choosing their representative in those congressional districts, and they will choose a Republican elector if we were following the Electoral College process, which means that having done that, and we do that, there's no way in heck they would be able to actually steal. It would be so hard for them to steal the election, because now they have to play down into very specific districts. And guess what? Where do you think all of these bogus votes are? And I'll give you in 2016, not 2012, with the Trump election, I looked at the percentage of voter turnout in the state of Washington. Seattle was in the 90 percentile. In other words, it was 35 to 40% higher than the national average in voter turnout. And in all of the dark blue counties, all of the counties that were dark blue, they had astronomical 90 some percentile, which what that means is that they were very successful in stuffing the ballot box. And this is why when we looked at, I think it was 2020, where you were seeing states that had more votes than people.
Yes, sir. I was just about to say that.
Right.
They had more votes than registered voters.
And all of those votes are occurring in the blue counties because they have full control over those counties. It would be very hard. That's why I say they need to do winner take all. Folks, we need to take back the Electoral College. This is the whole point I'm throwing out here. We need to make sure that it no longer is winner take all, and that we, the people, choose. That way, we actually have the control over who's going to be selected. And if we did in the Republican, you know, congressional districts where we get a Republican representative, we would also have a Republican elector. And if you actually counted, you know, the votes back and forth via the House of Representatives and the Electoral College, even though there's two for each Senate, right? I mean, so the state legislature goes and they choose those two. If it's a red state, then they will choose all Republican. In other words, it would completely do away with any of the Democratic votes for those two seats. But the point is this, is that when we look at how all the numbers go, if the people were choosing their electors and we did away with the winner-take-all, then they would have to try to go to the 12th Amendment because there's just no way they can win. It's hard, except in states like Washington where they do, you know, mail-in ballots permanently. If they have mail-in ballots, they have almost full control over the process. The interesting thing is that in Washington State, the algorithms only work in the key, i.e. the presidential, the governor, those types of races. They don't monkey around too much in the counties where, you know, the county legislators and the people that are being selected for the state legislature, those numbers are usually not played with to, you know, to create these advantages. Does that make sense? In other words, the algorithms only are working in changing votes for the president, for the governor, for these big key positions and seats.
Senators.
Right. So that way, in a red state, if you know, when they're playing these games, because how many red states have dark blue counties? In other words, population centers that make up the majority of the people, almost majority of the people. Like, look at Indianapolis. Indianapolis is, you know, it's Chicago. Now, Chicago is a blue state, but Indianapolis is a red. It's a blue city in a red state. And so this is where these population centers, because of the democracy, has changed everything. So the bottom line is, if we actually started invoking the Electoral College the way it was supposed to be, the way that the framers defined it in the ratification base, that we, the people, choose our electors, then in so doing, the state legislature wouldn't be choosing the electors for the Senate. It would actually be probably either two at large, or they would split the state to say this half of the state gets, you know, an extra elector at large, and this half of the state gets the other elector. That way, the people are literally choosing two electors, one for their congressional district and the one at large. If we did that, the presidential election almost all the time would probably be a lot closer or won by Republicans. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So following the Constitution is really the remedy. In other words, getting strict compliance to the Constitution is really the way we can, and the only way we're going to take back America. Because they know that all of these little things that they're violating from the Electoral College and everything else, they have created advantages and they're gaming us. And this is why we're in the pickle that we're in. And so as we go into break, we'll come back, and what we'll do is we'll finally move on and get back into Article 2 of the Constitution. I just wanted to kind of close everything from Article 5 yesterday to, you know, the Electoral College and those things today. So now I think, because we covered these things already, the electors as well as the Senate and the 70, we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now we're getting back to Article 2. We kind of covered the Electoral College. Let me see. We also covered a go-back yesterday in looking at Article 2. We kind of covered that thing of the advice and consent, the Senate stuff, and so forth. Now in Section 3, let's pick up with Section 3 because this is where we talk about the State of the Union. Now, keep in mind, there was nothing in Article 1 regarding the State of the Union. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So, in other words, who has the control in managing the State of the Union? Most people, because if you remember the Trump administration, Pelosi played games with Trump. Remember that?
And yes,
And she tried to make it later. I think she actually had it slide back. She was playing games with him. Let's read what Section 3 states.
He shall from time to time give to the Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. He may, on extraordinary occasions, convene both houses or either of them, and in case of disagreement between them with respect to the time of adjournment, he may adjourn them to such time as he shall think proper.
So, let me just stop right there because that's where the yellow is. So, in other words, the president is the one that is going to give to Congress and the people of the United States the State of the Union. He has the control over this, folks, and he can choose, and he can actually go over into the body of the whole, or the main body, the big room where the senators and the representatives meet. It's the big room, and so this is where the justices come in and sit. Everybody comes in and sits. He has the control. There's nowhere here where the anything pointed to the Speaker of the House dictating and inviting and controlling the time, manner, and so forth. You see, anything that was handed out to the state, or I should say to the House of Representatives, that control in the Constitution? Heck no. And so if they created a law that empowered them to basically do that, well, is that law in pursuance to the Constitution? Because, folks, when they make a law, it has to be derived on very specific powers enumerated. In other words, if it was enumerated for the president to do this and not the House, then the House, or I should say Congress, can't make a law taking control of it. Hopefully this all makes sense, folks. But just so you remember, we right now have a Republican control. You remember, Sean, in 2018... In the 2018 election, the Democrats took control of the House of Representatives. I think they may have even taken control of the Senate. And that's when the shenanigans began. And Pelosi played these games. And I think even, she did this to literally create, this disadvantage in trying to make the president look bad because an election was coming up. Anything they can do They play all these shenanigans and anything they can do to change the outcome. Remember, the ends justify the means. But what Pelosi did was a direct violation of the Constitution. Period. Okay, now you can go into He Shall Receive. Go ahead.
Okay. Section 3, he shall receive ambassadors and other public ministers. He shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed and shall commission all the officers of the United States.
Okay, so there's three really big points here. One, he's the one that receives the ambassadors from other countries. He's the one that does the diplomacy. He's the one that works out the deals. His administration and his... I'm not a fan of being able to go back and forth. As a matter of fact, because we allow this ebb and flow from Democrat to Republican, we hate you now, we love you now. And it literally changes back and forth between, you know, communist states or, you know, hostile nations with Republicans where they're bad. And then, the Democrats get in there, oh, we love you. I don't know if you remember Obama, he did that big reset button. Oh, we're going to reset relationships. And that was a big fiasco. The point is that I think that this diplomacy, even though he should receive that, I have a problem with the president being able to make such drastic changes with the strategy of the union. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
And so I believe that the states are the ones that should actually say, you know what, these communist nations are a threat to us. We will never have direct relationships and trade with them. Or whatever, let the states actually have the voice in saying this is how it's going to be. Because when we have presidents can actually go against the common sense and actually, because our problem, folks, is that we have people waging direct insurgencies against the Constitution and against the people of this republic. And so they have agendas. They get into office and they use their agendas. And even though it says that he shall receive them, it doesn't mean that there's really nowhere here. It's just baked in or implied that the president sets the demeanor and the tone of how we're going to receive and deal with every nation. He gets to say, you know, we hate China now because we understand they're hostile, and we're not going to be doing what the former administration did by mollycoddling them and letting them get away with murder. We can't
literally.
And we can't be going back and forth. The states really need to be the ones, and this is where that equal suffrage, where we really look at having the state legislatures and controlling of the Senate, I believe that is where it should really be kind of set, that this is the strategy. We don't care that you still receive the ambassadors, but these countries are no touch. You can't touch these countries because they are a threat to our sovereignty. They are a threat, they're a global threat, and they're a threat to this nation. And because we have presidents that actually defy those common sense logic and reason of, these are hostile enemies and they make them friends. And in so doing, Bill Clinton received millions of dollars from China. In so doing, the same thing with the Biden administration, same thing with Obama. And actually, in some of the Republicans, even the Republicans did that, making billions of dollars, bringing billions of dollars in, selling us out. So I understand that they should have, the federal government should be the face in dealing with the external world. But we are a Republican form of government, not a, create a dictator or a tyrant. So it needs to be representative. That's why the president should be representative of the people. The House is representative of the people. The Senate's representative of the state. Even SCOTUS should be representative, but they're not. That's a huge problem. because they're representing the Ivy League and the, I'll just say, the progressive agenda from the education system, which is why they rule and they do all the things that they do, because they've been indoctrinated into that concept from those schools. This is why, if we actually change that, and I think I've mentioned this before, that the state, the governor, or the state legislature should basically appoint that Supreme Court justice every 4 years, and then that, you know, after the 4 years, it changes. They don't have to keep that person in. This is where we would actually see justices on the Supreme Court that came from state colleges instead of the Ivy League. I don't think America is being properly served because the Ivy League has a stranglehold on the court, and that's the progressive agenda. So anyway, let me stop going down the rat holes. Let's go ahead into this last one. And he shall take care the laws be faithfully executed. In other words, let's look at the Senate and suffrage in the Senate. That's a law that's in the Constitution. The Constitution being the supreme law of the land, he can enforce and make sure that they're being executed. So if senators choose not to vote for the way their state legislature told them, they want to defy that without the consent of the state legislature, then he has the right to faithfully execute, that to remove them. And actually, because Section 3 of the 14th Amendment exists, that is the supreme law of the land as well. Anybody that defies their oath of office by failing to support the Constitution, which is what those senators did, by not giving the state legislature their equal suffrage in the Senate, then the president has all the power to remove them in executing that law. There is no due process. Once you've been pulled, you are banned for life. Now, let me ask you this, Sean. If all of a sudden we had a bunch of senators that were pulled and removed, do you believe that when the new senators come in to replace them, and these senators say, you know what, we want Congress, and we're going to appeal to Congress to overturn this disability, so that we can at least get back into office, so we can be, you know, the slime, you know, belly scurrying vermin that we are. And so do you believe that they would even have a chance in heck of getting 2/3 out of the Senate after being removed?
I doubt it very seriously.
Yeah, I doubt it, because everybody that goes in there that replaces them, they're not going to give up that seat. Nobody gives up that seat. You're too close to the mantle of power. Now, there may be honor among thieves. If it's only onesie twosies, they might be able to do it. But you still have to overcome the other house. And when it comes down to it, we have yet to see party lines in the House of Representatives ever to go down that path of, you know, of overwhelming. It's usually by, you know, a majority. In other words, what I'm saying is I've never seen, and you could go and look and do the research, how long has it been since we've actually had one party, 2/3 of the representatives, all a part of one party, to have that level of control in the House of Representatives? That's a huge number. And we never see that. It's usually like within 20 or 30, you know, not a big significant number. Now, help me out. So how many representatives are there in the House of Representatives?
435.
435. Cut that in half, and that is basically, let's just bump it up to one so it's even, 436. That would be 218. Mm-hmm. So to get, that's 50-50. To get to 66, so if you times, you know, or if you take the division, however you want to do it, the 2/3 of 435, what number is that?
I was an English teacher, not a math teacher.
Okay. So if you take 435 and you times that by 0.66, what does that come up to? 287. Okay. So in other words, you have to have more than 287. You have to have 288 to actually, you know, get to overturn, you know, somebody's disability. And if you take 287 and you minus that from 435, that means that the other side would have 147. So it's 287 to 148, I mean, to get to the numbers. Because I'm moving the decimals, I held it all. It should be 148 to 287. Folks, go through the history of the House of Representatives between the Republicans and Democratic control. It's never come close to that. So the point is that when these people get removed because of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, and because these creatures do everything by the party agenda, which is all unconstitutional, they would still vote to basically keep it from ever allowing, because the Democrats have never had that level of control to let these bad guys back in. It requires two-thirds of both houses, not just the house that they came from. So, anywho, my point is that if we actually looked at the president faithfully executing this law, he would be able to start removing senators. He'd be able to start removing congressmen. As a matter of fact, AOC, if you look at it, the facts are in. AOC should be gone. She's been waging an insurrection against the Constitution. Many of that gang of whatever, they've all violated it. And they should be removed. And it's the president's job to faithfully execute the law. Why, I've said this so many times, why has the president not basically taken the Department of Justice and completely rewired it? I don't care about anything else right now other than full compliance to the Constitution. If the president used the Department of Justice and got rid of everybody, says this is what we're going to focus on now. Every person in the United States who is under oath, who fails to fulfill their oath, will be removed from office. And he executed that as the law of the union. We would clean up California. We would clean up every blue state. And actually, then we'd finally be able to overturn these ballot agendas and so forth. Because regardless of the representation being Democrat and Republican, even though the parties you'd still see Democrat and Republican in the state house. Now the state house, anybody that votes for the digital currency, anybody that votes for things that are unconstitutional in the state house, you get removed because the DOJ is going to be right in there and say that vote for that bill, the fact that that bill even made it to the floor, whoever sponsored it, you're gone. That is an unconstitutional bill, and it should never have been presented.
Sanctuary states.
There you go. All of these things, folks, I'm telling you. This is why at the very beginning of every show when I talk about the appeal to heaven, you know, pray, learn, or learn, pray, act, I follow that up with it's all about full compliance of the Constitution. If we had a president that was actually getting the full compliance of the Constitution, by getting rid of all of these people, then the states could actually do their job and perform republic review by auditing and shutting down every unconstitutional vestige that has been assumed, created, magically, you know, through magic has been poof, it's there in the states, throughout the federal, you know, government, all these things that they've done. We could finally get rid of, and we would no longer have that debt. As a matter of fact, we would be able to prove that the debt is fraud. And basically, this is when the president would have the honor of telling the world that, you know, all these nations have been not only deceiving us, as well as the people in this nation. We've had people in office that have been defrauding the American people, and your government has been defrauding you by buying into our debt scheme. Because that, you know, the fact is we can't spend money on things we don't have the authority. All of the spending was fraudulent, and the people that have been controlling your money and giving it to us has been enabling us to do these things, which has given us money to give to you, or I should say giving back to these other nations, ensuring that communism moves forward. As this goes out to the people, they're going to realize that this global scheme has been undermining their liberties all this time. I don't know a person, even if you asked a Democrat, because they're not really ideologically wired, if they're a communist, it's different. But Democrats are usually, you know, these progressives. But if you ask them, do you believe the state should tell you what you should have for dinner tonight? No. Individual choice, individual sovereignty, individual liberty is still an acceptable paradigm for even Democrats. Only communists say nobody should have those types of privileges. The state will dictate what you can do, who you will marry, you know, how you're going to work, when you'll retire, when you're going to die, whether you have a family. The state dictates everything. That is a hardwired communist. They don't belong in America. And as a matter of fact, once we start taking all this back, so Section 3 has been this, you know, this long grandstanding for me. But the point is, folks, if we had a constitutional president, if Trump actually understands that he has the ability to fully enforce the language of the Constitution, not worrying about whether the Congress is actually, because when you look at Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, Congress doesn't need to create a law. The president, he clearly says that these people are to be removed immediately. If Congress wants to make a law in the processing of all of that, that's fine. But the president has the supreme law of the land on his side in getting rid of everybody violating their oath. Period. Newsom, gone. All of these bad actors, gone. And this scares the crap out of everybody in the political arena because they all know that they've been taking advantage of the system. You know what? This is what I tell everybody. You had a good run. It's over. No more. We know what the law is. We're going to enforce the law, and it's done. You're done. And we're never going to get back into this mode where people like you will ever be able to take advantage of we the people ever again. I'm telling you, folks, when you look at the 14th Amendment, you can't tell me his DNA isn't in that, just like the rest of the Constitution. Full accountability is the essential part of a sovereign people and sovereign governments and sovereign nations. Full accountability. So anyway, he also will have the commission. He'll basically be able to commission his officers and so forth, those people who he chooses to put in, but at the advice and consent of the chief executives and so forth of the Senate. Let's do Section 4, and that kind of wraps us up, and then we'll have some time to get into Article 3. Go ahead.
Section 4, the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors.
Okay, so they're basically laying down this thing called the impeachment and a treason and so forth, so the president can be held accountable, right? If you notice, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment does not use the word president. As a matter of fact, the word president and vice president that's in there is pointing to the electors for choosing them. In other words, if you have an elector that chooses a communist president, then you can hold them accountable because they should never elect a person that is actually openly, like Obama, said, I am going to violate the Constitution and give you health care. I'm going to create Social Security. I'm going to operate outside the Constitution, ergo that vote for that president, because it's very tracked. We all see how they vote. And so those people who vote for communists that have openly said that they, I mean, this would keep Obama from ever getting elected. Does that make sense?
It does now, for sure.
Yeah, because now we know that they can't do those things. So if they get into office and they actually deliver on those promises, those electors get removed just like Obama gets removed. They'll never be able to be an elector again. Now, elector is really more of a position of, let's just call it, an honorable or a position of honor. Because it's not like you're compensated. There's no compensation for an elector. Your job is to understand the issues and understand who's going to represent those issues best, and then go and have a campaign in your congressional district to say, I believe that these issues are the most important. This person represents that the most. Therefore, I'm an elector for that person. And so I will choose that person as president, and I will choose this person as vice president. Because technically, the president does not have the power in the Constitution to tell us who his vice president is going to be. The Electoral College has that authority, only the Electoral College. And this is these are so there's so many violations to the Constitution in all of these different processes. So with that, this right here basically states that this is not overturned by Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. The process of impeachment will go forward and it is, will be maintained because Section 3 does not touch or affect the chief executive as well as the vice president. So with that, let's dive into Article 3.
I have a question about the electors.
Yeah.
So if you're an elector and you say this is the person that I will vote for, so what I'm saying is they have electors for each party, right? Like they had the Democrat electors, and no, actually, whoever wins that district or county, they their elector is chosen.
Well, so the electors actually are the ones that do the campaigns for the candidates. So technically, the electors represent the candidates.
Okay.
And the party actually started paring things down. They got America into a model that basically says, we're going to have a primary. We're going to pare it down to who we think is the best Republican candidate. We'll have the primary, and then, you know, that's who will win. So they basically took away, by having the primary, injecting the primary in 1856, the party literally took away the power of the electors, because the electors are the ones that actually choose the president, not the party. The party is, this is how the party got its nose into the tent and started taking control. They now control all access to every political position in the United States. At least the partisan positions, so they say. Anyway, does that make sense? Did that answer your question as well?
I don't think it answers my question because I'm still confused as to how the electors get chosen. Like we talked about winner take all for the states. So if the president wins the popular vote, then all of the electors go to him.
Well, so the popular vote, the popular vote is not constitutional. If you read, so we read the 12th Amendment, right?
Yeah, I think that's why I'm confused about how the electors are chosen. And like when Trump was elected, we had a slate of electors for him and a slate of electors for Biden. And,
right.
And supposedly in one of the states, they falsified or supposedly did it wrong and they were trying to cheat for Trump or something. It's kind of confusing, you know, for someone who's not versed in it to understand exactly how they're chosen.
Well, so the electors are chosen by the people. In other words, when we have the 2024, when we have the 2024 election, the only names, we're out of time, the only names that you should see on the ballot are the electors. You should not see the candidates for presidency. The electors are the ones to choose the president and to choose the vice president. And then there's a very specific process moving forward in how they literally go down that path of giving these guys, you know, very specific, I'll just say, the electors have the control over who becomes president and who becomes vice president. Just because I'm running out of time, let me just bring this up tomorrow or next week. We'll be back with this. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.